Good morning and welcome. You are tuned into 2SER 107.3. It's 10 o'clock. You're listening to Final Draft, Books, Writing and Literary Culture. My name is Andrew Popel and every week it is my pleasure to bring you new books from Australia and around the world. It has been an interesting week in the world of literature. America lost one of their great men of letters, Philip Roth, author of such novels as Portnoy's Complaint and American Pastoral. And in Australia, we've had the Miles Franklin long list announcement. Always a highlight of the year, always interesting to see what has made the long list and just to have another fantastic reading list, maybe set up a book club around it. There are some amazing books that I hope to talk to you about over the coming weeks. But of course, it is the last week of the month. It means it's time for the Australian Classics Book Club. This month, we are discussing Thea Astley's The Multiple Effects of Rain Shadow. It is an insightful, evocative, chilling novel, taking a look at a fictional version of a Palm Island-type place where almost 100 years ago a terrible event took place. It explores racism. It explores the effects of colonial government on this country. I am joined by David Winter and also novelist Chloe Hooper. So it is the Australian Classics Book Club featuring Thea Astley's The Multiple Effects of Rain Shadow. We're going to take a short break and then we're coming back to discuss the book.
Look behind the scenes of Ghost in the Shell with anime architecture at the Japan Foundation Gallery. Exhibiting original concept art and animation cells, anime architecture shows the artistry behind the imagined worlds of Japan's sci-fi cult classics. Catch this free exhibition from June till August 11 at the Japan Foundation Gallery in Central Park. The Japan Foundation Sydney sponsors 2SER 107.3.
You are tuned in to 2SER 107.3 and you're listening to Final Draft. It is that time of the month again where we delve deep into a classic of Australian literature for May to look at Thea Astley's The Multiple Effects of Rain Shadow. And I am joined, as always, by the indomitable David Winter. He is a senior editor at Text Publishing, and it's always my pleasure to welcome him into the book club. David, how are you?
Very good, thanks, Andrew. Nice to be back.
Nice to have you. And we are also joined this month by Chloe Hooper. Now, Chloe is the author of A Child's Book of True Crime and The Tall Man, and she's also written the introduction to The Multiple Effects of Rain Shadow for the Text Classics edition. Chloe, thank you for joining us in the book club.
It's lovely to be here. Thank you.
I admitted off air how excited I was to talk about this book, and I think just the setup alone will give the listener an insight. The novel details the events on Doban, an island off the North Queensland coast. The island is run like an open-air prison under the charge of Superintendent Brody. Following the death of his wife, Brody goes on a murderous rampage, detonating the island's buildings and hunting those he believes are seeking to overthrow his authority. He's finally stopped by a deputised local man, Manny Cooktown, while the white settlers hide in the remaining buildings. And these events set off the action of the story, told and retold from differing points of view by those who were there. And as they unfold, we learn of the oppression and the systemic racism of the authorities. That is really, this is one of those books where that sort of synopsis is just the launching off point. But David, before we get too far into The Multiple Effects of Rain Shadow, can you introduce Thea Astley to us, please?
Well, Astley was the prominent Australian female writer in the post-war era dominated by Patrick White. So through the 1960s and 70s, that was a period when Christina Stead was a fairly remote figure. Elizabeth Harrow was underappreciated and Amy Whitting and Olga Masters were yet to flourish. So really until Helen Garner came on the scene with Monkey Grip in the late 70s, Astley was a dominant figure in as an Australian female writer. She was born in 1925 in Brisbane, and she went to a Catholic school and then the University of Queensland. She trained to be a teacher, she married, and she moved to Sydney, where she worked in a number of schools and then at Macquarie University. She became friends with Amy Whitting, the writer, and she was famous among her group of friends and fellow writers and critics for her sharp wit and her great company. Her first novel was Girl with a Monkey, and that was published in 1958. And across the next 40 years or so, she published a work of fiction every few years. She won the Miles Franklin for The Well-Dressed Explorer, her third novel, in 1962. And some of her many notable books include A Kindness Cup, which was a groundbreaking examination of frontier massacres of Indigenous Australians, And in the late 1980s, It's Raining in Mango was a very popular book. She wrote full-time from about 1980, but retired from writing in the mid-90s. And then a large federal government grant coaxed her back. And the result of that was actually the multiple effects of Rain Shadow, which we're going to discuss today. And then one more final novel, Drylands, which became her fourth Miles Franklin winner and the first since 1972. And she died about 5 years later in 2004. Astley wrote 16 works of fiction and won 4 Miles Franklin awards, but only one of her books has been adapted for the screen, and they've appeared on just 4 university courses in the last decade or so. So I think it's fair to say that she's perhaps a slightly unfashionable writer now. Her style is often dense and ornate, figurative, sometimes heavily ironic. And I think unfairly, her works are sort of ghettoized as examinations of odd misfits and the horrors of colonialization in the tropical north. But that, to me, obscures her importance as a pioneer of historical fiction that has a fierce sense of social justice, especially the white mistreatment of Indigenous peoples. So to me, she remains a really significant figure in Australian writing, and she probably is to Queensland what Randolph Stowe is to Western Australia.
I definitely remember Astley from sort of school and university courses, but confess to not having come anywhere near her books until The Multiple Effects of Rain Shadow appeared for our book club. And look, I found this a deeply affecting novel, and it had so much to say, I found, about our world today. But I was hoping, Chloe, that you could start us off with some of the actual events from which Astley departs in The Multiple Effects of Rain Shadow.
Certainly. Well, Astley was inspired by an historical incident. Palm Island off the northeast coast of Australia was settled as an open-air prison for Indigenous Queenslanders who had been, in inverted commas, troublesome on other mission settlements. And this place was out of sight and run with terrible cruelty. And there was a superintendent there whose name was Robert Curry, who was an ex army man who had overseen the settlement of the island, and one government official later noted Mr. Curry practically regarded this settlement as a child of his brain. He regarded it as a sort of almost like a feudal lord, and when it turned out that some of the white staff were trying to have him thrown off the island, he went berserk and dynamited his own house with his drug children inside, and then went out trying to kill a doctor and who he regarded as responsible for his trying to undermine him, and he set fire to some of the settlement's buildings. And finally, the white staff on the island gave a gun to a young Aboriginal man named Peter Pryor, who is in this book as Manny Cooktown, and they all hid, and Pryor was forced to shoot Robert Curry, something which he never recovered from. I mean, I should also say he then went to jail for the shooting, which is another horrendous detail.
In itself, those events are just absolutely shocking. In the early part of the book, I had this real sense of, in Astley's writing, almost a horror movie, that sort of encroaching doom, particularly the events of Brody stalking around the island. Had that sort of, you know, horror filmic quality that we come to associate sort of from the 70s and 80s on, of the stalking killer. But then this expands out further, and we look at the effects of those events. They're replayed through different characters' eyes. And one in particular, and I was really curious about both of your takes on this, because We have so many points of view, including Superintendent Brodie's, Mrs. Curthoys, who's the she's the former publican who sort of sets up house and looks after the guest house on the island, the teacher. And in between, we have the voice of Manny Cooktown, the man who was given the gun and ultimately shot Superintendent Brodie, stopping his rampage. And Chloe, in your introduction, you note the possible impacts on the reader of her adopting, of Astley adopting Manny Cooktown's voice in these interceding sections. I felt that, you know, my modern sensibility, I was like, I do feel there's something problematic about this use of dialect and voice, and you talk about the appropriation of voice. But I wondered what effect it had on both of you and whether there were any thoughts we could come to about how it might have been done differently, because it is so highly effective in the novel.
David, do you want to go first on this?
Oh, wow. Yeah. This is probably the single most difficult thing about this novel. How else would it be done? Well, I think Chloe's introduction raises a really good point, which is that because these sections are kind of interstitial, they're not given the same weight that the white perspectives are. I mean, they do repeat again and again, but they're really quite short, and so they are played down in the narrative. And so I don't know whether my argument here is that Astley should have doubled down, if you like, and done more in Manny Cooktown's voice, but it does seem to represent or to be an embodiment of how this book is really told primarily from a white perspective, and it's interested in primarily in the effects for white protagonists, which is not to invalidate the novel at all, because it has so much to say. I think now if someone were setting out to write this novel and they were not Indigenous, they probably would not tackle the Manny Cooktown voice direct, like in first person.
Yes, the only Indigenous character who is given the same sort of the same fictional treatment as the white characters is Normie at the end of the book, who's Manny Cooktown's son.
In the introduction, Chloe, you sort of note that the way that sort of use of voice, the overwhelming voice is coming from the white characters, means that these are ultimately colonial perspectives, and they carry that baggage with them. And again, I'm so in love with what Astley did with this novel. That's why I wanted to reconcile this part of it, because I felt like Manny Cooktown's voice offered something so incredibly important. I think there is a lot to be said in the argument for how authors use voice, and I want to sort of hear more of it. Would there be a way to use voice with... I mean, I'm thinking about the prospect of this novel being written now, as you mentioned, David. Would there be a prospect of a collaboration? Do you think this is the sort of thing that authors would need to work together on? Or is this something that should maybe have, in a modern novel, just not go there?
Well, I just would say quickly that if a non-Indigenous writer were to write the same novel, if you like, I think that they would be encouraged to seek out sensitivity readers for those sections written in that voice. But I can't see Thea Astley ever having wanted to submit to the process of having a sensitivity reader. And, you know, obviously I want to be clear that I think her intentions were wholly good. And, you know, she spent an entire writing career and a very substantial one devoted to examining the thing that doesn't want to be examined by not just the society as a whole, but many white writers.
Yeah, and
I think if you sort of now look back at the work, I mean, it is a generational thing when you look back at a lot of white Australian literature. Probably there are things which, you know, now seem you know, wildly inappropriate. But I agree with David that Astley's intentions were you know, to our eye, good. I mean, she really was interested in this and horrified by the realities of what is, you know, what was and sort of still remains in certain places to essentially be apartheid, and you know, did investigate this in fiction when other authors weren't looking at it. And so I don't think it invalidates the novel. I think it's still important in a lot of ways, I guess the characters, these white characters, how they live with themselves in the midst of the structural racism that they're in sometimes benefiting from is interesting in itself. And I mean, there are moments when she tells those stories with a lot of poetry.
You are in the Australian Classics Book Club. This is Final Draft on 2SER 107.3. My guests are David Winter and Chloe Hooper, and we are discussing Thea Astley's The Multiple Effects of Rain Shadow. We are going to come back and discuss the book a little bit more, but first let's take a track. This is a debut single from Perth-based singer-songwriter. It is absolutely beautiful. Her name is Tanea Harper, and this is Graceless. You are tuned in to 2SER 107.3. Right there, that was Tanea Harper with Graceless. Now, you're listening to Final Draft, and we are in the Australian Classics Book Club. I'm joined by David Winter and Chloe Hooper, and we are discussing The Multiple Effects of Rain Shadow by Thea Astley. One of the really remarkable things about this novel is the way it weaves the story in and out of these different characters, and to the point we come to recognise characters purely from turns of phrase that they use before they're fully introduced in a section. And that allows Astley to really build almost in a tapestry these events, which I thought was hugely important for the events as they're portrayed, because I think it would be too simple to look at these events from one perspective. And I thought that was really, really beautiful. And the ways that race relations and race is explored was more all the more powerful for having characters that are, you know, blatantly racist compared with characters that are trying to be more sympathetic within, I guess, their time.
I like the way that you describe the book as a tapestry, Andrew, because Astley has an amazing eye for detail and an eye, obviously, for historical detail, feel, place, and she does embroider the stories together in a very rich and clever way. I mean, she just has a feel for narrative that's very distinctive. I suppose what we're getting at in a way is you know, and I don't want to sort of just quote myself like Elle Macpherson, but the idea of, you know, in exploring this, exploring this colonial world, whether or not there is this sort of colonial blind spot around, which I think also sort of, you know, perhaps is in the book, around those other voices.
I found it allowed this building up of ideas, and very interestingly, I mean, I think from our perspective, we can look at this and we can talk about the systemic racism and the injustice and how we may, from a generational perspective, have a much different idea of things. And we can see those ideas reflected, but very interestingly, they're reflected in people who have relatively little power to do it. The scenes where Mrs. Curthoys is encouraged to take in people from the island because it would actually give them an opportunity to kind of get themselves set up. We have Mr. Vine's son, who is Matthew, I think, and his intentions in going back to Dobbin to make a difference. And then we have Normie Cooktown and his receiving an education and then going back to agitate for change. But these are all relatively, I guess, weaker powered compared to the superintendent characters, the deputies, who really exert this authoritarianism, which is maniacal. Is that something of the realism of this? I mean, there was never a happy ending in this book.
No, and
never meant to be, I should say.
No, and there's I think you make this point in the introduction, Chloe, that really everyone, all of the whites, to greater and lesser degrees, are also victims of the system. And I don't think there's any search for kind of moral equivalence there compared with what is done to Indigenous peoples by the system. Just that it makes the point that this is not a handful of white oppressors who are gleefully enacting, you know, a series of despotic actions. I mean, even the superintendent, there's some, I suppose, some sympathy or some understanding there in looking at the war background and so on. And I think that's why it's a, you know, it's a rich tapestry, to use your excellent word, Andrew.
I mean, I think that you're right, though, that there are there are sort of moments of resistance that the characters all have, and that does sort of point towards change and the possibility of change. But I think that at the same time, Astley sort of recognised that in a way this story is, you know, can feel as though it continues to repeat itself. That is the idea of the rain shadow. It's how far good intentions will actually carry us. And it does seem significant that in 2004, a few months after Astley died, there was a death in custody on Palm Island, and then a subsequent riot, which has been in the news just recently because Palm Islanders have had a 30 million. Those who were affected in the riot have been awarded a $30 million settlement due to the racist behaviour of the Queensland police. So she is sort of remarkable in terms of having, perhaps at a point when others weren't looking at this island, actually sort of identified it and identified the cyclical nature of the history, you know, and happenings on the island.
I wonder about that cyclical nature that you also mention in your introduction, Chloe. Is it drawing too long a bow then to look at perhaps Astley's trying to parallel the entire invasion of Australia, this idea that somehow a kingdom could be carved out that would be like a little Britain in the south against Indigenous inhabitants and against the climate and against all other things, so that everyone ultimately kind of suffers from this project?
I think that's a very clever reading of the book.
If I can move us in a slightly different direction, though, one thing that I guess I kind of joyed in the novel is Astley's clever wit and observation, and particularly around gender, insofar as so many of the female characters suffer for their gender, as women did at the time. Astley just has a way of putting the words into their mouth that are just sardonic and cutting and pointing of the way forward.
Well, she does have such a wry style, and that is one of the pleasures, I think, of reading her, is her wit. And of course, this was another sort of, you know, David spoke about her strong interest in social justice, and certainly justice for women was something that she felt very strongly about. I think she sort of published poetry, didn't she, as a man early in her career, because she'd be paid £5 rather than £3 for a poem, and was a sort of trailblazer as a female writer in Australia.
Yeah, and she would be roughly contemporaneous with Gwen Harwood, who might have even gone to the same school, although I don't think quite at the same time, but grew up in Brisbane as well. And, you know, a similar attitude to the publishing world in at that time, you know, that why not write under a pseudonym and be paid more? And, you know, always ensuring that there were some very sly digs at men in much of their work.
I just enjoyed it. I mean, it may be one of the depressing aspects of this novel that it is so timely, because we're dealing with a novel set, you know, almost 100 years ago, and so many of the issues seem so topical. But I think anyone could pick this up today and find something that speaks to us about, you know, this idea that of the time women were being made responsible for men's sexual desire, and the violence that was committed against them is drawn from our headlines. The idea of the wage gap and male privilege is addressed. Mm-hmm. It's all drawn from our current discussion, which is both depressing, but I loved that it could speak in such a wonderful way about that.
No, I think that's right. I mean, I think that's why, you know, some of the flaws despite her having such an extraordinary historical vision, you know, history will kind of perhaps not judge, you know, some of the stylistic elements of this book so well. And but I don't think it invalidates it. I think that, as you say, there are some very rich pleasures all the way through.
You are in the Australian Classics Book Club on Final Draft. We are discussing Thea Astley's The Multiple Effects of Rain Shadow. Today, I have been joined by Chloe Hooper. Chloe wrote the introduction to The Multiple Effects of Rain Shadow, and she is the author of A Child's Book of True Crime and The Tall Man. Thank you for joining us, Chloe.
It's lovely to have spoken with you. Thank you.
And my regular book club companion, David Winter. He's a senior editor at Text Publishing. Thank you again, David.
Want to advance in your current role? Considering a career change? Or maybe you're thinking about the next step in your studies. No matter where you're at in your life story, join us this month for a UTS Postgrad Info Evening to chat about your options. Don't put it off. Explore where postgraduate study can take you. Jump online at pg.uts.edu.au to see the schedule and register for the sessions you're interested in. University of Technology Sydney sponsors 2SER 107.3.
You are tuned in to 2SER 107.3. It's Final Draft time, but not for much longer. Today we had the Australian Classics Book Club. It was Thea Astley's The Multiple Effects of Rain Shadow. If you missed it, head over to 2SER.com, search for the Australian Classics Book Club to catch up on all of the amazing books that we have featured this year. I want to say thank you to David Winter. He always joins me in the book club. He is a senior editor at Text Publishing. And also to Chloe Hooper. She's the author of The Tall Man and joined us for this week's conversation. The Vulture's Nest is coming up. I am coming back next week with a fantastic debut. It is from Bridie Jabbour. She is a journalist. You probably know her name. And we're going to be discussing the way things should be. I'm Andrew Popel. For now, I'm going to say bye and go do some reading. See ya.